Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck of katelovingschenck.com and the author of the upcoming Prayer Prescription Series. My guest this evening is Kevin Miller, and our topic is eco-anxiety, what to do about it. Kevin has helped to spearhead the Hive of Planet Loving activity in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in response to the Bill McKibben 350.org, that would be 350.org, the message about climate change. Today here in central Pennsylvania, we have had numerous tornado warnings, and now we are experiencing flash floods. How can we humans avert a climate catastrophe? The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Kevin Miller. Good evening, Kevin.
Good evening, Kate. How are you this fine rainy evening?
Oh, it is beautiful. Isn't it dark skies and foreboding forecasts of disaster? Oh, my gosh. Well,
it's just beautiful. As I was mentioning to you before we went on the air, I'm sitting in a pool of irony talking to you. I have parked my big gas-guzzling SUV in the back parking lot behind an enormous gas station in their parking lot, and I'm looking out over a beautiful pastoral scene of a green field and beautiful green woods with the rainy sky above it. But we are all complicit in this climate change crisis that we're all dealing with, and that's part of the problem, isn't it?
Yes, and now we want to talk about the solution, about the Hive of planet-loving activity. I know that we, in our little hive, we have a member who is very, very active in creating electric cars. So we have all kinds of different things going on in our hive that we hope to translate to other communities across the United States and the world. I think we can. So you drove up there in your UV mainly because you don't have reception down at your house. I don't want you to feel guilty. I don't think people should feel guilty or shame about somehow, you know, contributing to this, even though we are. But shame and guilt is not going to help the situation, is it?
No. As a matter of fact, I have a theory about why so many people are what we call climate deniers. And I think part of what's going on for a large percentage of the population is not just denial, but it's a feeling of profound deep guilt. We know inside all of our minds that we are complicit in this climate change crisis, that we are the problem, that the human species has not done a very good job of managing its technological adolescence, and that in the process of developing technology and industry, we are despoiling our own home, our planet. Bill McKibben, I thought in his, you know, what has spurred all of us into action is Bill McKibben's wonderful, wonderful article in Rolling Stone magazine on July 19th, 2012, or it was called Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. And that article got 500,000 shares within 2 weeks.
Wow.
112,000 Facebook likes, 12,000 Twitter mentions, 7,300 stumble upon tags, 5,000 reader comments. And what Bill says in that article about our mass guilt is this, and I'm quoting here, since all of us are in some way the beneficiaries of cheap fossil fuel, tackling climate change has been like trying to build a movement against yourself. It's as if the gay rights movement had been constructed entirely from evangelical preachers or the abolition movement from shareholders.
So I think
he's really on to something there. What I think, Kate, that we need to do is forgive ourselves. I think we need to forgive ourselves and each other. We need to stop polarizing our voices into camps and factions. We need to agree that whether or not you think this thing is caused by human beings, that climate change is happening to such a degree that it threatens the existence of life on the planet in the future, and therefore we need to do something about it. Let's stop fighting about stuff we don't need to fight about and get on with the business of saving ourselves.
Yeah, I think forgiveness. And also, the loving the planet is somehow so integral to this whole thing, as well as loving ourselves. We have to love ourselves. But and seeing in that extension of loving ourselves, to see ourselves as a part of this beautiful planet, I mean, it strikes me as how, chemically speaking or scientifically and chemically speaking, that our bodies are the exact same ratio to water, to all these cellular things that are going on in the body, perfectly reflect our mother, the Earth.
That's a beautiful statement, Kate. It is also true that all of us, all of creation, was born in the Big Bang, and that you and I and all of the plants and animals and trees and the planet itself, we are all made of star stuff. And as such, we are integrally unified with all of creation. And when we realize that, then, of course, it becomes easier to feel deep in our bone marrow what's happening to the planet. And we recognize very quickly that this crisis that confronts humanity is the moral crisis of all of human history. This is the big one. And we have a moral requirement to do something, to do whatever we can.
Right.
You know, I heard about the ice caps melting about 12 years ago. It was the first time it hit me what was happening. I was listening to National Public Radio, and I heard about the ice caps melting. And I went into a kind of a low-grade stomach ache depression for a year.
And came
out of it. You know, that's eco-anxiety. When you first figure out, when it first hits you that my goodness, the planet is in jeopardy. And I don't mean just life on the planet. There are plenty of scientists now saying that there is a possibility that we could have as much as 11 degrees Fahrenheit of warming by just after the midpoint of this century. And if that happens, we will create a science fiction nightmare of a planet upon which life cannot exist, and where life is very unlikely to start over again in a new cycle of evolution. So we aren't just talking about saving ourselves and saving the life on the planet. We're talking about saving the living planet itself.
Like a living organism, a life form that is just as alive as you and me. But there are so many people that are in a tremendous state of denial, as you said, the climate deniers. And then you have the press and the political jargon constantly talking about jobs as being the main problem. But really, you know, what is this underlying? Do people have an underlying anxiety about the environment that they aren't aware of, is what I would wonder.
Well, I think so, Kate. I have a feeling that most people are aware that this is happening, and they feel just simply overwhelmed
mm-hmm.
by the enormity of the problem. And in fact, I was at one of our Hive meetings. We call our little group in Lancaster the Hive of Planet Loving Activity. We were formed about 6 weeks ago by myself and by Reverend Jerry Lee Miller of the Church of
mm-hmm.
the Brethren. And then we
mm-hmm.
were joined in leadership capacity by Spencer Johnson, who is an environmental studies and creative writing student at F&M College here in Lancaster. We were at a Hive meeting a couple of weeks ago, and one of the young women in the meeting came up to me afterwards, and she said, "You know, I'm so stricken and taken by everything that's been said here this evening, and I want to do something, but I just feel so overwhelmed.
Yeah.
I feel so little and so powerless." And I think many of us tend to feel that way. Jerry Miller himself,
yes.
Who helped me join create this Hive of Planet Loving Activity, told me that after he read Bill McKibben's article shortly after it was published on July 19th in Rolling Stone magazine, he said he had to lie down on the floor and just grieve for a while. And, you know, I do too sometimes. I have to just take a day to just grieve because
right.
it's a very, very serious situation. But what I want to say is
mm-hmm.
that there are, in fact, things that we can do. There are
right.
ways to turn eco-anxiety into eco-action. It is not too late. There are, in fact, very powerful and positive steps that we can take, and we can turn this thing around. It has been proven. Germany is proving that this thing is reversible. And I'm even more excited that they are the ones proving it with Angela Merkel, who is a conservative, right-of-center chancellor in Germany. When she was Minister of the Environment, she instituted programs to switch from fossil fuels to clean, renewable energy in Germany. And last month, August 2012, there were a number of days when well over 50% of Germany's energy was generated by clean, renewable solar arrays and wind. This is the proof that it's doable.
Oh, that's great.
This problem is not a lack of technology. It's not a lack of understanding of how to do it. It's a lack of political will. And we the people, are the ones who have to provide the political will. You know,
mm-hmm.
many years ago when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president of the United States, before my time, his people came to him and described Social Security to him and said, "Mr. President, this is what we have to do. We have to do this new thing called Social Security." And FDR
yeah.
looked at them and he said, "You're absolutely right. Now, make me do it."
Oh,
make
that's
me
beautiful.
Do it.
Make me do it. Oh, that's beautiful.
So that's our charge, Kate. It's time for us as deeply concerned citizens to make the oil companies, the fossil fuel companies, switch from the poisons that are killing us and the planet, switch from oil and gas and coal to clean, renewable wind, solar, geothermal, tidal, and other energies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time for us to also insist that the governments of the world do the same.
Yes. And, we're in this middle of a political season, which is so full of a lot of yammer-jammer, but I would assume that given the latest Romney political crisis that President Obama will again be in power. So I think he'd be a little easier to talk to about this incredible, overwhelming problem that we have. He would probably be one more likely to listen, and I think it might be a good idea. Well, we talk to our local political people. But we need, I don't know, we have talked about that in the Hive, going to political, local political figures to get them to do it. But I'm just not sure, you know, how to approach that one. I mean, that's a hard one.
Well, yes, it is. It is hard because, of course, politicians and governments are in bed with the fossil fuel companies, which fund their campaigns and their government programs. So it's pretty tough to talk politicians and governments out of continuing to develop fossil fuels. But it's time for us to start really pushing, Kate. I mean,
yes,
as Bill McKibben said in his speech here in Lancaster at F&M College the other day, just asking isn't working. Just asking,
right.
Asking nicely isn't working. It's
right,
time
right.
To, it's time to stop, you know, being Mr. Nice Guy about this and start making some real noise and showing some muscle. And
yes.
If you're interested, I have three big actions that I would like to ask people to consider taking.
Go ahead, tell us.
Well, let me just back up for a minute and say that for decades we have all been looking at smaller kinds of things like replacing all our light bulbs with those wonderful twisty light bulbs and riding bicycles more and buying less auto fuel and buying hybrid cars and recycling, and all of those things are good and they're all very important. But you know what, Kate? We are out of time.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
there isn't enough time left to change the culture enough that it will force a change in our energy sources. So what we have to do is do it the other way around. We have
mm-hmm.
to force a change in our energy sources first because we're out of time, and then the culture will follow. So here are three big things, better and bigger than changing our light bulbs, that I hope all of us will start to think about doing. Number one is Bill McKibben's request to all of us when he spoke at F&M College on September 13th. He is urging all of us to divest from all of our fossil fuel investments. So divestment, as we all know who lived through it, is the way that South African racist apartheid was ended in
mm-hmm.
1994. It was largely the divestment movement in which students in the United States of America insisted that all of the universities and colleges and other organizations and businesses divest their holdings from South African concerns. They financially, economically forced apartheid out.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill McKibben said, let's do that again. Let's follow that lead, and let's all talk to our investment counselors about getting the oil and coal and gas out of our portfolios. He asked the students at F&M College to talk to the administrators there, and he's asking students all over America to do the same. So divestment is number one. Number two, I'd like everyone to consider starting something like a Hive, like we have started in Lancaster, or joining an existing local environmental action group, if you have one in your area. I have a 12-step plan for helping you start one if you're interested, and I can go through that for you later if you like. But find another person with whom you feel compatible, who is passionate about reversing climate change, and start a Hive of earth-loving activity in your own community. If you can't do that, find an existing group and join that, or join 350.org and offer your services and your help to Bill McKibben and his group to build their global movement to reverse climate change. So that's number two. Start a Hive or join an existing organization. And number three, Kate, you're going to be excited about this. I am giving you the exclusive scoop. I'm announcing on your radio show.
Okay.
The first announcement of a big development that is coming from the Lancaster Hive. Reverend Jerry Lee Miller and I have hatched an idea that we are calling Fossil Fuel Free Friday. This is a boycott movement that we wish to plant in the grassroots of America and fertilize and water and nurture and watch it grow. The idea came initially from Reverend Jerry Lee Miller, and I added to it, and we've thrown it back and forth. And here's the basic idea, Fossil Fuel Free Friday. Every Friday, remember when we used to not be able to eat fish on Fridays? Well,
a lot of people
sort of like that.
Yeah, right on.
Okay, so there are three levels of participation in this boycott that you can choose from. So you don't have to go all the way over the cliff to not using fossil fuel. You can start gently and move up your participation as you are able. So the first level of participation in this Fossil Fuel Free Fridays boycott is, number one, first level, the lowest level of participation, don't buy any gas or oil from ExxonMobil on Fridays. So if you absolutely have to buy gas on Fridays, go somewhere else. You know why? ExxonMobil last year made more money in 1 year than has ever been made by any business in the history of money. ExxonMobil all by itself has 7% of the reserves of gas to take us all the way to total disaster. So
yeah,
they probably didn't
pay any taxes on that money either.
Very likely. If we pick ExxonMobil as an example to show the other oil companies that our buying power can be felt and we don't buy from ExxonMobil on Fridays, I guarantee you that will be noticed. So that's
I would probably extend that to every day of the week, not to buy ExxonMobil ever.
You know, eventually I think we should. We're planning to start out modest and make this thing grow. The second level of involvement, if you feel able to do this, would be to add a little more pressure on the oil companies and move up to buying no fossil fuel from any company on Fridays. So if you simply don't buy fossil fuel at all, don't fill your car on Fridays in honor of Fossil Fuel Free Fridays, that would be something you could do to move up your commitment. And finally, the highest level of involvement is one that very few people will be able to do, but that's using, not buying or using any fossil fuel at all on Friday. That's a tough one, I know. But I also know many people who are already there. They're living off the grid or partly off the grid. They're riding their bicycles. They're not using fossil fuels. So there are some people who can do that. So those are three big, big actions that I feel we can all consider taking to make a difference on a macro level to reverse global climate change. Again, number one, divestment. Number two, join or start a hive of planet-loving activity. Number three, Fossil Fuel Free Friday.
Beautiful. That is beautiful.
And, you know, these things are more powerful than we know. As Bill McKibben reminded us, it was this kind of activity that ended apartheid in South Africa.
Right. I was going to say one little thing about the divestment movement, and I believe that it would have Bill McKibben and others say it would be spearheaded by the college students. You know, but anyway, I think we all have to participate in that.
Well, I think so too. You know, college students are the ones who spearheaded the divestment movement that ended apartheid. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison and came to the United States for the first time, who did he go see before anyone else? He went to the college campuses to thank the students for spearheading
right.
the divestment movement.
Wow, that's beautiful,
so,
isn't it?
So those three big things are some things we can do, and we all need to work together to think hard about how we can put more and more and more pressure, economic pressure, on fossil fuel companies and governments to make them switch to renewable
mm-hmm.
energy. I also feel, by the way, Kate, that look, I've been working for corporate America for 22 years as a facilitator of new product development. I'm a consultant. Money is the only language they speak. They speak one language, and it's money. I feel that when they do get the message and start thinking about switching to clean renewables, we need to make it so lucrative for them that they couldn't even imagine not doing it. Money talks. Let's make it talk both hurting them in the pocketbook when they hurt the earth and us, and let's make it a reward for them. Let's reward them richly when they do the right thing.
Now, wouldn't the wind and the solar and all this, these wonderful renewable sources of energy make somebody some money? I mean, I'm sure it would.
Oh, no question about it. It's that's, you know, again, we have our model in Germany and the fine work of Angela Merkel. I never thought I would be holding up a right-wing politician as an example for how all of us should behave. But I bow to Angela Merkel. This woman has shown the world that a major economic power, an old world European nation, can change from fossil fuels to clean renewable energies in a short period of time. She has succeeded. And we owe her a great debt of gratitude for that.
Absolutely. Well, concerns about the environment is a great levels the playing field. There's really no reason at all for when people gather together to discuss these very important issues about the environment that we would ever want to even know what their political party is or who they're voting for or what kind of religion they have. These things are not important. The most important thing is for us all to preserve the beautiful mother that we have.
You know, you're so right, Kate. Concern for conservation of the planet Earth, our home, trumps all political affiliation. And as Bill McKibben said last Thursday here in Lancaster, you know, this should be a conservative issue. He said, all we're asking, this is a quote from Bill, all we're asking for is a planet that works a little bit like the one we were born into, which, if you think about it, is a pretty conservative request. That's a quote from Bill McKibben. And, you know, he went on to say, and I don't have his exact quote here, but he went on to say that what's extreme, what's radical, is the people who are changing the chemical composition of our atmosphere. That's what's radical.
Yes.
And for those of us who are aware of that change in the chemical composition of the atmosphere and the oceans, do you know that the oceans are now 30% more acidic because of all the CO2 in the environment? It's changing the oceans. The air that is all around us is holding 5% more moisture because warm air holds more moisture than cold air. That's absolutely radical. It's radical.
Well, didn't you notice that this summer here, and I have never seen such moist air as we had this summer here in the good old Lancaster County. I mean, I have never experienced such a thing. It was like sweat just pouring. That would be one way I could say it. That would be one way I could possibly say that was happening.
Well, yes, and let's go back a number of months and remember that we basically, here in our part of the country, we basically had no winter.
Right, that's right.
On my 12 acres, I have a half-acre pond, which is 11 feet deep, and every winter it freezes over with a nice thick 6-inch sheet of ice, and we can walk on it and play with the dogs on the frozen ice, and all
mm-hmm.
of the koi in the pond. We have something like 100 koi in the pond that are between 1 and 3 feet long. They all go down and bury themselves in the mud and hibernate, and their heart rates go down to 1 beat per minute, and they sleep. The pond never froze over, Kate. The pond never froze over. The koi never went to sleep. We had tropical plants that survived the winter outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's radical. I was working as part of one of my consultation projects for a corporation in Minneapolis. I was in Minneapolis in mid-March. Now, we all know what Minneapolis is like in mid-March, right? I've been there before when there were 50 inches of snow on the ground.
Yeah.
I and my team sat outdoors at a restaurant in our shirt sleeves at night after dark and ate dinner on a patio in mid-March in Minneapolis, and we were perfectly comfortable.
Oh, dear.
Now,
don't you also think that the climate change isn't just, I have to tell you about a fig tree. We have fig trees out here. Unbelievable. 22 years ago, we could never have grown figs on this property. Now we have them all over the place, just a bounty of beautiful tasting, wonderful, they melt in your mouth kind of figs. But the thing about climate change is that it's not just getting warmer. I think what we're experiencing is a lot of extreme climate and weather changes, so that maybe this winter isn't going to be warm, but it might be very, very dramatic weather. Lots of rain or, yeah, whatever it is, it's going to be dramatic and kind of like you better, you know, hang in there because it might be tough.
That's right. Every 1 degree Celsius of warming radically increases the chances of extreme weather events. And you're quite
mm-hmm.
right that new species are coming into the area, and unfortunately many of them are not as pleasant as your tasty figs. Reverend Jerry Lee Brown likes to talk about these, what are they, striped mosquitoes that have invaded Lancaster that never used to be there before. And poor
right.
Jerry, his favorite thing, he doesn't ask much out of life. This man serves nature and humanity and God, and all he asks is a few hours now and then in his garden to contemplate life and nature and spirit. And he can't do it anymore because these striped mosquitoes are just biting him to oblivion, and we can't
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
we can't risk that because we have now so many diseases being spread by these mosquitoes, and that's just one example.
Yes, it is.
Kate, would it be appropriate for me to just go over Bill McKibben's three numbers with you?
The three big numbers. Go over the three big numbers, and then describe how people can. What a hive of planet loving activity is, and how what we've done with it, and how other people can do that too. So start with the three numbers. I think that's very important.
Okay, yeah, this is where our movement in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, got started. Again, it was Bill McKibben's Rolling Stone article entitled "Global Warming's Terrifying New Math." You can Google it. Google Bill McKibben, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, and it'll take you to Rolling Stone, and you can read it. It's a tough read, but it's definitely worth it. He asserts that there are three numbers that have emerged, which tell us that time's up, we have to do major actions now. The very first number is 2 degrees centigrade, which is the maximum amount of warming that can be allowed and still sustain life as we have known it on the planet Earth. 2 degrees Celsius is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
We have already warmed up 0.8 degrees Celsius, which is 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit. And unfortunately, you know how when you get a locomotive rolling downhill, even if you turn off the engine, there's still inertia there. There's
mm-hmm.
inertia built into this system, and there's another 0.8 degrees Celsius of inertial warming built into the system, which brings us up to 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit out of the 3.6 degrees that we can afford to warm. So we're already three quarters of the way to the point where the planetary system begins to break down as a habitat that can sustain life.
Mm-hmm.
So that 2 degrees Celsius is a number that has been agreed upon by the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit in 2009. 167 countries agreed to that limit of 2
mm-hmm.
degrees Celsius. Then the next number, the second number, is 565 gigatons of CO2. Now, a gigaton, mind you, is a billion tons. 565
wow.
billion tons of CO2, carbon dioxide, is the maximum release of CO2 allowed by mid-century if we're going to avoid catastrophe. Unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
at our current rate of CO2 emissions, we would reach that number, 565 gigatons, by 2028, which is just 16 years from now. So
mm-hmm.
as you can see, we would have to radically curtail our burning of fossil fuels and our release of hydrocarbons in order to avoid catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
And the final,
mm-hmm.
the third number, is one of the most sobering of all three. This number is 2,795 gigatons of CO2. That's 7,295 billion tons of carbon dioxide are trapped in proven coal and oil and gas reserves that companies and countries are currently planning to burn. Now,
wow.
that is five times the allowed maximum of 565 that we can release. So
mm-hmm.
here's the scary thing. Fossil fuel companies and countries have already committed to burning five times more fossil fuel than this planet can withstand without catastrophe. So we are out of time. We are at the point where it's time to say to fossil fuel companies and to countries around the world, enough. Follow
yeah.
Angela Merkel. Follow the Amish. Follow anyone who is not extracting and burning fossil fuels and warming the climate. It's time to stop all of that. We insist, and we aren't going to give you our money anymore. Our dollars are votes. Every dollar
mm-hmm.
we spend is a vote. Don't vote for killing the planet. Vote
right.
for survival. Vote for hope. Vote for change for the better. Let's try to leave our children a planet that they can survive on. Let's try to leave a planet for our grandchildren that gives them a hope of a future. So those
mm-hmm.
are Bill McKibben's three numbers. 2 degrees Celsius is the maximum warming we can withstand. We're already basically three quarters of the way to that. 565 gigatons by mid-century is the most that we can release without catastrophe. 2,795 gigatons is the amount that fossil fuel companies are already basing their spreadsheets on, and companies are basing their books on as well. So
mm-hmm.
what we have to do is to find ways to put pressure on fossil fuel companies and countries. So when you asked me to talk about our hive of planet loving activity in Lancaster, when Jerry Miller and I got up off the floor after reading Bill McKibben's article and started breathing again, I said to him, well, I have three questions. What am I willing to do? No, well, my first question is, what can I do? My second question is, what am I willing to do? And my third question is, what am I qualified to do? So it hit me suddenly that for 22 years I had been working with corporate America as a facilitator of new product development brainstorming sessions all over the country and to some extent all over the world, and that I could use my ideation techniques from corporate work to invent strategies and tactics for reversing global climate change on a local level, and then and then encourage other communities to create hives like this as well. So Jerry and I put together our efforts. Jerry became the convener and leader of our hive, and made sure that he called everybody who he thought might be interested. So it only takes two people to start a hive. Jerry was the convener and leader, and I was the facilitator of the brainstorming session. Right there, you've got your first three steps of the process done. You gather the people that you invite together, you know, put together breakfast, coffee, tea, drinks, food, music, toys, art, make it fun. Have a good time. Ask all participants to introduce themselves and express a goal. And the facilitator writes down everyone's goals as numbered ideas on a flip chart. Number five, rules of the road for brainstorming. Have a few rules of the road, like headline your ideas, 7 to 10 words. You know, we don't have time for big, long speeches anymore. I'm a blabbermouth, and I talk a lot. But when I'm up in front of the group, I ask people to headline their ideas. Build on each other's ideas. Suspend judgment. Suspend ego and be willing to offer absurd partial whiffs of ideas and let others fix them and build on them. And then listen for ideas that you're willing to write up as a larger concept sheet. So everyone gives those ideas. You circle and initial the ideas on the list that you have posted up front that each individual is willing to write up as concept sheets. You write your concept sheets and report them back to the full group in 1 minute each. Part of what I do with groups is I do rapid imaging illustrations that go with each concept sheet. You create a display wall of those concept sheets and illustrations if you happen to have an artist, and do an advisory group vote on all of the concept sheets that you produce. Our group produced 44 concept sheets. I was very proud of them. And out of that 44, then, I asked everyone to nominate individual concepts or clusters of similar concepts that might form specific projects that we could actually do as a group. And we came up with eight separate projects that we could do. And then the last step is that you continue to get together regularly for support meetings and to solve any problems that you're coming up with in terms of how to implement the ideas that you've agreed you want to do. So our hive, one of the ideas we came up with, it was a wonderful moment of synchronicity, because we knew that that Bill McKibben was going to be coming to Lancaster to speak on September 13th. So we agreed that one of our projects had to be to focus on Bill McKibben's visit and how to amplify his message and put as much momentum as possible behind Bill McKibben's words and his presence and his message. So we really focused hard on that for several weeks. And I think we did a pretty good job, don't you, Kate?
I do. And then the whole divestment issue arose from Bill McKibben, which is sparking a lot of interest and I would say really lots of vitality and energy surrounding that.
Yeah, the speech that Bill McKibben gave at Mazur Gymnasium on Franklin and Marshall College campus was very well attended. The gymnasium was packed. His speech was interrupted multiple times by spontaneous ovations, and at the end, he received a standing ovation. People were lined up in the aisles at the microphones to ask him questions. You know what, Kate? One thing that's really coming across strongly to me right now is that people are hungry for the truth about what's happening with climate change. And the reason is that the major media outlets are not talking about it.
No, yes, they're not.
It's like the 2,000-pound elephant in the middle of the living room.
Yeah.
No one is talking about it. So people are starving for the truth. They're starving for facts. They're starving for information. They're starving for some hint of an idea of how they can respond to this crisis. So that's why, you know, within 2 weeks, Bill McKibben's article in Rolling Stone magazine was shared 500,000 times. That's why he attracts overflow crowds. That's why he was able. Do you know that he started 350.org, his global climate change reversal movement? He started 350.org with 7 college seniors and himself 4 years ago. And now it is a massive global movement. Major change and effective action can come from very small, humble origins.
Yes. That says a lot.
So he was telling us, he showed us a slideshow, which I know you saw because you were there as well, of one of his early events, the Connect the Dots of Global Climate Change event, which just got a surprising response. He received photographs from very remote villages in extremely poor regions of the world where people have nothing. They had no digital camera, so they took a regular photo, got it developed, and it didn't turn out very well, so they drew in the message on the sign they were holding up. One little village in a remote part of India sent a photograph of their little ragtag group of deeply impoverished people supporting the Connect the Dots of Global Climate Change event, and they sent their photo with a note that said, "All the water behind our dam is gone."
I know.
There were stories after stories after stories of poor people of color all over the world, and those are the people who are most profoundly affected by this crisis.
That's
right. Right now. They took their photos. They did what they could to support this movement. There was even a photo of some soldiers. I can't remember if they were in Afghanistan or Iraq, but these soldiers took a photo of themselves with 350 spelled out in sandbags on the ground, and a note with it said, "We're parking our Humvees for the weekend."
Yeah, that's beautiful. What we're seeing here with the Indian people losing their wells and such is the sort of, what's it, desertification? I don't know how you say that. The whole earth is becoming a desert, and it's starting and has moved very quickly across very poor nations, and you can see it here as well. I mean, we've had the biggest drought that we've ever had in this country ever this summer.
You know, I feel very intimately connected with that drought. My cousins, Ann and Kay, came to visit me from, and their parents came to visit us from Iowa and Illinois and Indiana. And they, for the days that they were here with us in Pennsylvania, where we are very lucky because we have had rain and it's green here, and we have living crops, but Kay and Ann and my aunt and uncle, Kenneth and Rosemary Miller, said that in Iowa, in Illinois, in Indiana, where they came from, all of the crops were dead, all of them. They said that everything was brown. There was no green anywhere. I know it's hard for us in this verdant Penn's Woods region to imagine that, but when I was driving them back to the airport through the countryside, my 85-year-old Uncle Kenneth was looking so wistfully out the window at the woods, the green woods.
Yeah.
And I said to him, it's beautiful, isn't it? And he said, yes, it is. I'm just trying to memorize how it looks so that I can remember it when I get back to the brown dead crops and trees of Indiana.
Oh, my gosh. Yes,
so it's
my
happening.
Cousin, yeah, my cousin lives in Indiana, and he was saying the same thing. I mean, everything is dried up. It just, all of it just died.
It's
and
happening
we,
right now. We,
yeah, we gave
often,
him a... Yeah, we gave him a rose of Sharon, and but for some reason that survived, and he sent us a picture of it. And my gosh, I know it's just that we have to not being here in this oasis is what we are here in Lancaster County. You can't be lulled into complacency any longer. The time has come for
the,
all
the
of us.
The time has come. The time is now.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't act immediately, we will not be able to leave for our children and our grandchildren and future generations. We will not be able to leave a habitable planet for them or for the animals or for the trees and the plants. We will leave a barren planet that cannot support life. It's time for us to develop an imagination. I know it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard for human beings to imagine that things could ever be different than they are right now. We look around us and everything is lush and green and our crops are fine. I'm still eating corn on the cob right out of the field, and it's fabulous. And, you know, we're having a fine summer here in South Central Pennsylvania. But you know what? It's not going to last.
Well,
and
it's not just about me. It's not, you know, it's not me anymore. And it has, we have to form communities. We have to gather together in a spirit of love, loving, and it has to start, we have to be outdoors to know what it means to love the planet. And so many people are kind of crouched in apartments. They're afraid of crime and being killed by other humans. And this is a travesty. I mean, people need to just learn to formulate what it means to be together in a spirit of community.
You're so
right.
And
that's what the hive is, you know?
That's right. That's right. And we have a number of people in our hive who are deeply committed to enjoyment of nature and the woods. We have people who lead nature walks through the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And Rich Humphreys does that. And his son, Case, is involved. We have people who live in the woods like I do. And we need to develop an ability to listen to our scientists. This is not hyperbole. This is not false. This is real, and it is happening now. And we need to be able to hear our scientists who are, as scientists do. You know, scientists are not, given to overstatement like I am. They're not dramatic like I am. Scientists tend to make very measured, careful statements. They tend not to make their statements until they have overwhelming proof. But scientists, don't trust me. Go look up a climatologist in your region and call the climatologist and talk to them. Ask them, is this real? Is this happening? And they will tell you that it is. There are 12. Go ahead.
Hansen, the head scientist at NASA, said that if we go through with this pipeline that comes through Canada, the XL pipeline, it's the end game for Earth. That's the head scientist at NASA. Why are we not listening to somebody like this?
Yes, and another thing that James Hansen said, James Hansen is one of this country's leading scientists. He's NASA's preeminent climatologist. And his comment about the 2 degrees Celsius maximum warming that Copenhagen said they would allow, his comment about that was, the target that has been talked about in international negotiations for 2 degrees of warming is actually a prescription for long-term disaster. We talked about island nations that will disappear, drought-stricken Africa that will be uninhabitable if we go all the way up to 2 degrees Celsius. So these things are already happening.
What is the name of your website, Kevin, so we can get people to read your blogs?
Okay. There are two websites. My good friend of 40 years, Paul, and I write a website called twooldliberals.com. That's the word two is spelled out T-W-O, so that's http://twooldliberals.com. We have 75-plus articles and a lot of my art on there. Then I have an art blog where there's a lot of information about global climate change as well, and that's http://kevinmillerartandjunk.wordpress.com. And please visit our Facebook page called Hive of Planet Loving Activity and press the like button because we need all the likes we can get to get to certain levels of service.
Wonderful. And also, I want to mention that you have done illustration for Self-Realization Fellowship work, of which I have always, I've been a follower of SRF and Kriya Yoga and Yogananda since 1993. And your beautiful illustrations are in The Wine of the Mystic and probably as well as other books that come out of there. That, we have had this book around for a long time. And some of those, oh my gosh, all of those illustrations are just so, your artwork is just so beautiful. And Tom and I were talking, my husband Tom and I were talking before the show about how your artwork could be a real focus point for relieving eco-anxiety and to make a statement about it. So we need to get that. You made this book that I have here that is just something you made up, but it could be made into a book easily enough about how the whole history of the hive of planet-loving activity that we have, it could be a real workbook for people for creating that kind of hive in their own community. So we need to get that book out.
Well, thank you, Kate. That book is a recipe for how to form your own hive in your community. If you want help, go to one of my blogs and get in touch with me, and Reverend Jerry Lee Miller and I will do what we can to help you start a hive of planet-loving activity in your own community. And in terms of your comment about art and how it can be an eco-anxiety reliever, if you go to Paul's and my blog, twooldliberals.com, we have been having a discussion back and forth in the last few days about the nature of consciousness and how consciousness is related to art. So you're right on target there. There's an example of one of my paintings, and Paul has created a simply wonderful exegesis about the nature of consciousness as revealed in that painting.
Beautiful. Well, we have actually come to the end of our hour. It's just beautiful. And we can send this around in the archives. The radio show can be listened to after the fact. And I really appreciate having this opportunity to talk about what we need to do and how we can do it and how we don't have to beat ourselves over the head about it. We just need to do it, damn it.
That's right, Kate. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I loved every minute, and I
Me
want
too.
To just encourage people to have courage and faith and hope. We can do this.
We will do it. We will.
We will.
Thank you again. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kate. Bye now.
Bye-bye.